Ka taki te titi, ka taki te kaka, ka taki hoki a hau, ti hei Māori ora. Ko taki timu te maunga, ko aparima te awa, ko murehiku te whenua. Ko taki timu te waka, ko kaitahu raua kati mamoe, waitaha te iwi, ko kituru toko inoa, no reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou, katoa. Mō reina, and good morning, everybody. I've just given you my pepeha, which originates from the deep south, about as far south as you can go, a little island called Whanuahou, just off the coast of Rakiura. I'm Kit Toogood, chair of the expert panel, appointed to determine the substantive application for the Taranaki VTM project submitted by Trans-Tasman Resources Limited under the Fast Track Approvals Act 2024. With me are the other members of the expert panel. On my right, Dr. Hilke Giles. On my left, Gavin Kemble. And on Gavin's left, Natalie Hampson. Absent today, unfortunately, is the fifth member of the panel, Loretta Lovell, who is overseas honouring a prior commitment. She sends her apology and good wishes. Notwithstanding the absence of one member of the panel, we have a quorum to conduct this conference. We're meeting today in a conference that has been convened pursuant to a minute issued by the panel on the 25th of August 2025. So that the panel may receive an in-person briefing from the applicant. The purpose of the briefing is to familiarise the expert panel with the content of the application for approvals, the content and structure of proposed conditions, including management plan, strategic plan, and the drafting style, key points of evidence, technical reports, assessments, and other supporting information, proposed site visit details, relevant legal tests and legal issues in contention, and other relevant matters. During the briefing, the applicant will present a high-level overview of the application. The expert panel will have the opportunity to ask questions about the application, noting that the panel members have familiarised themselves with the documents by the time of the briefing, but we do not have a detailed knowledge of the application at this point. This is not a hearing. The applicant will not be producing any evidence, and although that is the case, the applicant's representatives present and involved in the presentation will necessarily refer to the evidence filed with the application. Questions from the panel members will be directed to receiving information about the application and the material filed by the applicant in support. There will be no discussion between the applicant and the panel about the merits of the application. One of the purposes of the conference is to inform the panel's decision on which persons or entities should be invited to comment on the application pursuant to the panel's discretion under Section 53(3) of the Act. Comments on the application will be received by 8 October 2025, and the panel will then decide how it will conduct its consideration of the application and the comments and the evidence filed in support and its determination of the application. The committee intends to convene a meeting of the statutory participants, that is those identified in the Act who must be invited to comment on the application, and the applicant, and possibly some of the discretionary commenters, in Taranaki in the week beginning 20 October. After the applicant has responded to the comments that have been received. So a minute will go out confirming that week of the 20th of October for that meeting. And that meeting will take place obviously after the applicant has responded. I've used the word meeting in describing that gathering or hui because the panel has not yet decided whether that meeting will take the form of a conference such as this or a hearing under sections 57 to 59 of the Act. Details of the meeting, as I've said, will be advised by a minute prior to the closure of the time for comments. And the purpose of that meeting will be to enable the commenters to better inform the FIT panel of their views of the application, much in the same way as the applicant is doing here. The members of the panel will now introduce themselves briefly, and then representatives of the applicant will be introduced by Mr. Eggers. I note that the conference is being recorded and a transcript of the recording will be placed on the Fast Track website. I am a barrister practicing in Auckland and elsewhere as a mediator, arbitrator and investigator. I've spent my entire legal career of over 50 years in litigation in one capacity or another. A partner in small and larger firms, a barrister in King's Counsel, and I served as a High Court judge from 2011 to 2019 and again between 2021 and 2022. I'm now going to invite the other panel members to introduce themselves. Dr. Giles.
Thank you. Morena, ko Huka Giles Tukuenua, no Tiamana Okutipuna, no Kirijirua Aho Moreira Tunakato. My name is Huka Giles. I'm a marine and system scientist. I've got qualifications and experience in marine science, mathematical modelling, and system science. I've got experience assessing environmental effects of various activities on the marine environment, largely in the coastal marine area. I work for myself, an independent consultancy. I work for consent holders, applicants, regional councils, central government, marine ministry, primary industry, ministry for the environment, and I'm also a RMA commissioner. I've done quite a few hearings under the RMA. I look forward to this process with you.
Thank you. Mr. Kimball.
I'm Gavin Kimball. I'm a planner. Been practicing for coming on 35 years, although it doesn't feel that long. Work primarily for myself, or an entity at least, that I own a majority shareholding in. Prior to that, I was Trustpower's environmental manager for a period of time. So did a number of new renewable electricity projects throughout New Zealand, and indeed reconsidered a number. That has been a big part of my work since, but more recently in the last 5 to 10 years I've found myself dealing more in the coastal environment than anywhere else, and qualified hearings commissioner, undertaken I think 30 or 40 hearings, all but two, including this one I've been chair of. And working hard to make sure that I'm not one of those commissioners or one of those planners who just does commissioner roles. So I still do quite a few applications and present expert evidence before in the courts and those other things. So that's me.
Thank you. And Ms. Hampson.
Morning, I'm Natalie Hampson. I'm the owner and director of Savvy Consulting, economic consultancy based down in Wanaka in the South Island. I've been studying economic effects under the RMA primarily, but under a range of other legislation as well, for over 25 years. Do a lot of work with consenting, plan changes, fast track applications, and policy work for NEB. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Eggers.
Hi. Well, thank you for those introductions, and we certainly welcome this opportunity to present the project to the panel. I'd like to make two introductory remarks. Let's hope I can operate this. Here we go. I'm Alan Eggers, Executive Chairman of TTR, and I'm a fifth generation Kiwi. My family came out here in the 1850s and settled in the Tasman district, and are still there. The extended family is still there. I was born in Motueka. I went to Victoria University of Wellington, and I had a great experience at that university. I went as a mature age student and really went there to learn how to learn. And that university, man, did they look after me, and I had a terrific time. And that set me in good stead for a career in mining and mineral exploration and mining. And I'm now a professional geologist with many qualifications I won't bore you with, and a corporate company director. I've led some of Australia's top 200, one top 200 ASX mining company. And I started that company and that mining company in New Zealand. And it was New Zealand's 10th largest company at the time. And I built that from nothing. I'm an entrepreneur, that's true, but I also have high regard for the environment. And I might say that I was trained very well by an American company, Anaconda Mining Corporation. And what they did to me, they got me by the scruff of the neck and said, "You actually don't know all that much. And we're going to take you around the world and show you what mining is about." But importantly, they told me right from the start, 10% of your budget, Alan, in mineral exploration and mining will be for environmental work. This is back in the early 1980s. And it taught me a great lesson, and I've never forgotten that. So I have over 40 years of international experience now, and I have with me a great team up on the board here. And what I'll do is I'll introduce them briefly, but when they come their turn to speak, they'll give you a little bit more background about themselves. I won't do that right now. We have Dr. Alison McDiarmid from Earth Sciences New Zealand, formerly NIWA, here on marine ecology and sedimentation effects. We have Paul Majuri from Holmes Majuri Law, and he'll be speaking about Tikanga treaty settlement matters. We have Luke Faithful here from Mitchell Dace on project effects, summary and proposed consent conditions and management plans. And can I just say at this point that Dr. Phil Mitchell has been with us also since 2014, leading the charge on those matters for us, but he's unable to attend today and sends his apologies. But he will be available ongoing throughout this process, and he is part of our team. So that Phil will be available as we go through the consenting process. And we have Morgan Slyfield here, our legal counsel, on the relevant tests and legal issues in connection with the application. On behalf of TTR and the management team and our investors, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present the Taranaki VTM project today. I'd first like to make these few introductory remarks. I've been excited by and committed to this project from its inception. When the New Zealand Government and New Zealand Petroleum and Minerals back in the 2000s invited and encouraged mining companies to evaluate the potential of iron sands offshore along the west coast of the North Island. Our work has included considerable investment in expertise, research and risk capital, and has identified an opportunity that will be a game changer for the Taranaki region and the Whanganui district and New Zealand. It'll provide local jobs and help turbocharge the economy, the regional economy, while also making a significant contribution to the government's aim to double mineral exports to $3 billion by 2035. We have been granted a mining permit. That's not at issue here. We are seeking through this process to gain our marine and marine discharge consents under the EEZ Act to mine the vanadium and titanium bearing iron sands up to 36 kilometres offshore in the Taranaki Bight. We need these consents to then finance, construct the project and commence exporting of mineral concentrates. We ran exploration activities in 2008. We've been out there for a while. We've been committed to this project for a long time. And we've had, quote, statutory rights out there in the terms of licences to explore for minerals, including way before the EEZ Act, when we in fact had a continental shelf licence, it's the only way they could do it, outside the 12 nautical mile limit. We announced a major metal discovery in 2013. And when we were invited to go out there, it wasn't just TDR. We're the entrepreneurial end of the business. We saw the opportunity, and I'm a Kiwi, and I was asked to come back and invest in this project. But importantly, I think you should remember, at that time, from Manukau Harbour to Kapiti, the entire coastline was pegged, and it was pegged by Rio Tinto, one of the world's largest mining companies, FMG from Western Australia, and Sinosteel from China, and TDR. We were the minnow in amongst the majors. We're the only one left, and we're stuck with it. And I can tell you why later in the presentation, if you wish, why the others aren't here. But it does have to do with risk and the approvals process here in New Zealand. We have been working hard for more than 12 years and invested more than $87 million to gain the consents required. We are very close to $90 million at this point. The project will manage any impacts to protect the environment, and it will be profitable for those that have stuck by and invested in our company, including myself, many Taranaki people, along with international resource investors. The company is currently owned 30% around about by Kiwis. Importantly, the project will also deliver strong revenue streams in the form of mineral royalties and corporate taxes to the New Zealand, and be one of the country's top 12 foreign exchange earners by itself, not as part of the wider minerals industry, by itself. The strategic value of iron ore, vanadium and titanium we plan to harvest is huge. And it's no accident that the largest mining companies in the world, BHP, Vale and Rio, are all there basically making it out of iron ore from Brazil and Australia. And this resource and other resources that are known along the west coast of the North Island potentially could be described as the Pilbara of the South. There are significant resources out there, and I'll demonstrate to you here today the work that we've gone to and identified one major resource. There could be others. The project has the ability to place New Zealand at the forefront of the clean energy transition to meet domestic and international demand that ensures long-term economic stability and growth. A large number of highly qualified professionals and experts, some here today, have contributed to the project and the application before you over many years. And I'm very proud of all of them and the diligence and the excellence that they've brought to the task to increase our understanding of the project's outcomes, including the benefits and the effects. It's for these reasons I'm pleased to have the opportunity to present our project for your consideration under the fast track approvals process. So let's get on with it. I've got a lot of slides here, and I see that one panel member's printed them out, and I hope the colour printer survived. And we'll work our way through, and I think I'm absolutely fine with being interrupted or stopped at any point to answer a question or explain something as we go along. If it refers in detail to where I've got my experts with us, of course I'll defer to them, or we'll leave it till they do come up and address that issue. I'm not having much luck shifting this on. Was working. What's the? Do you know why, Elliot? Sorry,
that's all right.
It's just not clicking on. Do you think it'll work now? There we go. Okay, I think I've covered those points in my introductory remarks. As a way of background, the New Zealand government changed back in October 2023, and the coalition agreements between National and ACT and National and New Zealand, First New Zealand, set out what their policy agenda is, and it is very relevant, I believe, to what you people are considering here today. And part of those agreements were to update the Crown Minerals Act and promote the use of Crown Minerals. That's good, because the promotion of Crown Minerals have been taken out. The word promotion have been taken out of the Act over the years, and it's been put back in. Explore the potential for critical minerals. Get a critical minerals list. I'll tell you a little bit about that. Prioritise regional and national projects of significance. Improve consenting settings in relation to mining by fast-track approvals legislation. That's why we're here today. And investigate strategic opportunities for New Zealand mineral resources, including vanadium. Vanadium is the only metal mentioned in the coalition agreements. And develop a plan to develop these opportunities. So they got a briefing, as ministers do, by the incoming Minister for Resources got a briefing from MIMBI, New Zealand Petroleum Minerals, and iron sands along the west coast of North Island, sitting in 20 to 50 metres of water, could supply iron for steel making, construction, electric vehicles, wind and solar, and power transmission. Vanadium for steel, rebar. Vanadium's a key to hardener and steel. All hardened steels, all useful steels, in fact, have a lot of vanadium in them. Rebar, reinforcing bar for construction. And utility scale storage batteries, which they're building now. Vanadium redox flow batteries up to 800 megawatts in around the world. Australia's building its second one right now, not that big, but 200 megawatts and up. They're very large batteries. You can't get one in your watch or your car because of the way they're designed, but they're more efficient than lithium and they don't explode, and the vanadium doesn't decay, and you can use it forever. And titanium for the aerospace, satellites, paints, paper, white goods, electronics, medical implants, instrumentation, and building products. And MIMBI estimated an in-ground value of TTR's Taranaki iron sands at around $1 billion. That's in their briefing. And they said additional offshore iron deposits along that coast up to a further additional $275 billion. You'll have to query them exactly how they calculated that. And the fast track approvals legislation 2024 was introduced into Parliament on the 7th of March. The ministers originally were empowered with decision making powers under the Act. The expert panels would be appointed to review applications and make recommendations and determine a set of consent conditions as required. During the passage of the bill, the decision-making powers were shifted to the expert panel. So they rest on your desk now. Then the government, as part of its roadmap and its plan, sought to try and understand what it is, what's our mineral endowment, what are the potential, where should we be going here? And so they asked GNS, which I guess is now part of Earth Sciences in New Zealand, to give them a report on what they think is around and what is the potential. And in that report, our project features and the iron sands and VTM deposits are in the report, and our resource statement is in there, which I'll explain shortly. But the 3.2 billion tonne project is sitting in there as one of the potentials to be developed. It's a world-class resource. New Zealand does not have many world-class mining or mineral resources. This is one. We call it a tier one in the industry. And this is the kind of resource that quote Rio and FMG and Sino Steel are after. That's why they're here. They don't go around looking for small projects. They want tier one. This is tier one. And then by October, we had to apply last year, as you may recall, to the fast track process, had to apply to get listed to be considered, to be referred across. And during that process, I think there was, I was saying corrected on this, but about 389 projects or something of that order applied for fast track approval through that process. 149 were accepted by then a panel that the government appointed, and they referred 149 projects through. 19 of those were mining and quarry, and 11 of those were mining. And TDR is one of the 11 that came through, and we didn't need a further referral from the minister, so we're in, quote, the fast track process, subject to the legislation being put in place, and it wasn't in place at that time. So they then also did a critical minerals, got Wood Mackenzie, very well-known international resource consultants, and they produced the New Zealand's critical minerals list. Vanadium and titanium were both included in that list. And the development of the project to elevate New Zealand to be the third largest vanadium producer globally and the largest in the Western world. The window of opportunity is for New Zealand to capitalise on its mineral resources and particularly critical minerals. The opportunity is driven by growing global demand for these minerals and security of supply, especially for those used in renewable energy technology and electric vehicles, which I explained earlier. There's tremendous opportunity for New Zealand to be part of the global supply chain for critical minerals, quote, New Zealand Minerals Council. And then in January this year, 31st of January this year, after the Fast Track Act was put in place on 23rd of December, became law, the critical minerals list was launched by Minister Jones in Waihee, and as I said, vanadium and titanium are in there. And also it's interesting to note the critical mineral lists of the USA, the UK, the EU, Australia, Canada and China all have those same minerals in them, including vanadium and titanium. At the same time, the government wisely developed a mineral strategy for New Zealand to 2040. And that is how it's really their roadmap going forward of how they intend to implement their strategy. And you'll note on that there's a number of different commodities around the nation, but importantly along the west coast of North Island here in yellow, are the vanadium titanium rich iron sands. Are right up there in the headlights again in their strategy with the aim of doubling mineral exports to 3 billion by 2035. What are we going to do out there? Well, this is a little video of what we're going to do. Hopefully it will play. It's an animation. Hopefully it will give you some sense of perspective about what we're doing. The helicopters actually fly a bit higher than that, believe it or not, when they go off over the coast. But it illustrates what we're about. This is out here in the South Taranaki Bight, and the oil and gas industry operating out here. This is the area within our mining permit that we're seeking in this application, 66 square kilometres. The Maori platform, the Kupe platform's sitting right in here. We'll have three vessels out there, an IMV, integrated mining vessel, a transshipment vessel that takes the concentrates from here, dewaters them and puts them on to export Cape-sized vessels for export. None of these vessels will come into a harbour. We have biosecurity plans and all the rest of it. It's a very large vessel, 335 metres long by 60 metres wide, 12 metre draft. This has all been approved by Maritime New Zealand and certified by the American Bureau of Shipping. The plans are done. We are getting this, and we're working closely with technology partners, De Beers Marine from South Africa and IHC from Rotterdam, Royal IHC from Rotterdam, who build these things and have been operating these and the crawlers for over 35 years. We took the TRC, Taranaki Regional Council, the EPA and the Iwi Fishing Forum to South Africa and showed them this equipment in operation and environmental monitoring that's going on around it. We took them over there and showed them what's happening. This is not an experiment. These things are real. It's 480 tonnes. It's a vacuum cleaner. It doesn't suck up rocks or fish or anything else. It sucks up black sand. It's just black sand. It's all that comes up. There's nothing else where we are, and I'll demonstrate that shortly. It moves at 40 metres an hour. This moves probably a little faster, but the ship overall will only shift a few metres each hour. 8,000 tonne an hour is coming up. At one end of the ship here, you can see, comes up through the mineral processing, which I can describe more detail if you want, but in a controlled manner. We are not dumping sediment back in the ocean. In a controlled manner, through a diffusion system 4 metres above the seabed, we're putting it back from where it came. The only disturbed area is the 300 metres odd under the ship at any one time. Behind it, it's rehabilitating. In front of it, we haven't touched it. It is not a pit out there for 35 years with desecration. We are continually rehabilitating. This is the mining blocks, 900 by 300 metre mining blocks. The vessel's on four large anchors, and it largely shifts on those. It does have dynamic positioning capability. And we just work our way through the mining blocks. That's what we're doing out there.
Mr. Regas, can you just help me?
Sure.
So when you're taking the iron sand through the vacuum cleaner,
yes,
processing it on the vessel,
yes,
and at the same time discharging
behind us.
Behind.
Yes. And there are no chemicals, no toxins, nothing. The black sand coming up goes past some large drum magnets. We've got an 80 megawatt power station on board, which primarily does three things. Electrically drives the crawler, produces fresh water by a reverse osmosis plant, and I've forgotten the third one. Anyway.
It drives the magnetic separator.
And produces electricity for the magnetic separator. So, and it's a drum magnetic separator, and the material going past, about 10% of it clings to that drum. It's circulating and it scrapes it off as it goes, and that goes in as concentrate. The rest is just keeps going straight through and down. It's in the same seawater that it came up in, and it's going back down. There's nothing being added whatsoever. And there's no way for us to infuse anything there into that process. So we're operating an EEZ. A lot of people don't understand much about EEZ, and I think this is relevant. The EEZ is 4 million square kilometres sitting around New Zealand. It is not New Zealand's sovereign territory. It's under our custodialship via the EEZ Act to manage the development of resources and at the same time protect the environment. It's 15 times the size of the land area of New Zealand. And it has already 42% of it, or 1.7 million square kilometres, in protected areas and benefit protected areas. So it's not carte blanche, and a lot of those areas to do with protecting it from the fishing industry, not particularly necessarily from mining. But at the same time, it is already well protected. I think the rule of thumb around the world, some of you will know, is 30% of any nation's land area they try and get to into reserves and protect it, and I think they're doing well. We've already got 42 out here. So not bad. Now, a little red area here is where we are. And that's the South Taranaki Bight represents less than 1% of the EEZ. I can't put the project on here because you can't see it. It's a dot. So we zoom in. The South Taranaki Bight here is around 36,000 square kilometres, and really covers from Cook Strait out to the continental shelf to the west of Farewell Spit and Mount Taranaki. And it's less than 1% of the EEZ. And then we zoom in, and this is the permit area. I'll digress slightly here, and it's something in the future, but you'll see the bathymetry on here, and this is a quite important thing for your considerations. This here is the 12 nautical mile limit where this, and you'll see better diagrams of this in a moment. But we're outside the 12 nautical mile limit here for our application. Inside, of course, is the coastal management area where the RMA prevails. and we would need to go through the RMA process to get any approvals. Out here, we're under the EEZ. But the bathymetry here, you see, this here is 50 metres deep. And the reason for the big bulge here, out here, is a very large titanium magnetite iron sand deposit, which we have discovered. That's why that bathymetry is as is. Our friends from the wind energy have come along and said, but we want this area to put our offshore wind turbines. They describe it as the Goldilocks zone of the South Taranaki Bight. And there's currently legislation being put in place, and I won't go into that, but they're putting in place legislation to permit offshore wind energy. And the reason the wind energy people came along and said, well, the choice for New Zealand and the government is to make a choice between mining and what the mining companies do to the world and clean, green wind energy. Well, if I went to the shopping mall on Saturday morning and saw that up, I'd probably sign that too, say, let's have clean, green wind energy. Why not? I'm also a grandfather and I love the country and I don't want it wrecked. But why do they want, and why did they plant their proposals right on top of us and then ask the nation to make that decision? And that's what they've done and they've asked the government to. And right now Honourable Simon Watts, Minister for Energy, is putting together legislation on how they allocate space out here for these two, quote, competing activities. I'll say a couple of things. One, they don't need to be competing, there's room for us all. But two, we're here and they are here because they cannot put their turbines in water depths greater than 50 metres. And there's their problem. They want to be on top of us because of the bathymetry, and that's our iron ore deposit. We can't go somewhere else. We are not mobile. We can't go mine here because it's not economic. We can't go mine up here because it's not economic. The minerals aren't concentrated. They happen to be concentrated here, put here historically by these rivers during the last glaciation when this was the old coastline, when sea levels were 50 metres lower. We don't have time today to go into global warming and all the rest of it, but that's why we're where we are. And these deposits have been upgraded by natural processes associated with sea level rise in the last 10,000 years. Not very long, and sea level's risen 40 or 50 metres in that time. Okay. So as I said, it's a busy, busy little area. It's not a pristine environment. There's a lot of existing interests and activities going on out in this area. There's oil and gas. We have an operating agreement with the OMV joint venture. They've agreed to work with us, and we're happy with that agreement, and they're happy with us. And in the end, at the last hearing in 2017, they supported us. And we have an agreement. Fishing and trawling. You've heard that some of the fishing industry are opposing us. That's true. We're talking, we're actively engaged with Tallies and Seafood New Zealand again right now. And I think we're making some very good progress there, but we don't have an agreement. Importantly, in FMA, which is Fishing Management Area 8, out where we are here, we do have an agreement with Sandfords, the largest quota holder in that fishing area. They are happy with us. They came to the hearing and supported us. So we do have some friends. The proposed wind farms is another issue, and we approached them and we've written to them twice. We're open to sitting down and working with them through the issues so that we can see how we can coexist and operate together. I can say they can't plant big wind towers right where we need to mine. That will become a hazard for navigation and our large vessels out there, and Maritime New Zealand would have a lot to say about that. And that would be to do with safety. Right, and as we go through this, commercial shipping, there are nearly 7,000, probably more, commercial movements of large vessels in the South Taranaki Bight each year. Harbour dredging takes place on the harbours around here, including top of the South Island, but along here and up around to Taranaki. And that seems to be okay. And they actually will create much larger plumes and dumps than we will ever will do. And I'll show you the data on that in a moment. But that's a permitted activity. Land use activity have generated river sediment, and I'll show you something about that. But the problem here, if there's a sediment problem and a problem for the marine life and the marine ecology in the Kaimoana, in this part of the world, it is not mining, it is land use activities and the sediment loads coming in from these rivers along here. And I'll give you some information on that. Recreational fishing and diving is non-existent out where we are and quite infrequent along this coast. And in fact, I think it was the Paratia Fishing Club admitted that they only have a few days a year where they can actually get out there across that bar. And as you may know or remember, just recently was a tragedy going across that bar as well, which is very sad. But the thing is, this is a rough coast, rough part of the world, and it's very dynamic, it's very turbid, and there's a lot going on here. Okay, we have tenements. We have a mining permit, mineral mining permit, 55581, of about 250 square kilometres sitting in here, outside the 12 nautical mile limit. And we have mineral exploration permit, 54068, sitting in here, which is quite a bit larger, of around about 635 square kilometres. This is being converted right now to a mining permit simply because mining permits and exploration permits everywhere but in New Zealand are ephemeral. They don't last forever. We have our work programs, we have to go through those, and they reach the end of the natural life, and you either have got to a stage where you found something and you need to move on to a mining permit or go away. We have found something, and I'll show you the resources in there shortly, but that is now being converted and needs to be done by the end of this year, so that when you read in the papers that yes, we've got a large mining permit out there, another one, it will be, because that's how the system works, and we've got a large resource out there. We make no apologies for that. Okay, we developed technology, yes, little old TDR, and our partners in Cooper Drilling and New Zealand Diving and Salvage developed the technology to actually drill these deposits on the seafloor. And we've got very large resources, which is the Kupe North and South, Cook North and South, and a Tasman North and South. The reason we have North and South again is because it is quite approval system cuts right through the middle of the deposit. So it's an artifact of that and not the resources. They are contiguous and all of equal value. Like, how do we find these resources? We did a huge amount of work. First of all, we threw detailed airborne magnetic surveys from Manukau Harbour, where you landed on the plains if you came into this place in the last 24 hours. We then undertook multi-beam sonar bathymetry surveys to understand the seabed and the seafloor, high-resolution boomer seismic surveys to get depth perspective of what's going on beneath the seafloor. We know how deep the sands are. We did remote observation videos of the seafloor, and in fact have videoed the entire project area. And we hope that you'll avail of the opportunity to come out and have a look, and you can run the cameras yourself and have a look around on the seafloor and see what's out there. We won't set it up, we'll set up the equipment. You can do that. You have a look. You tell us what's out there. We then did resource definition drilling. We've drilled extensively down to 40 or 50 metres in places. We've got previous oil and gas holes, but we can only actually mine with this equipment down to about 10 or 11 metres. And we're harvesting the top on average 5 metres. And we're only doing that for about 200 days of the year for 20 years. We are not mining for 35 years and dumping into the ocean. We have 72% utilisation of the equipment. The other 28% is downtime for servicing and weather events and other requirements, and we are not operating during those periods. So only about 200 days of each year for 20 years. The consents we're seeking are for 35 years, that's true. And the reason for that is that we need to do 2 or 3 years pre-commencement monitoring. We've done a huge amount of work out here. We understand what the ocean is, and Alison and her team done a fantastic job of that. But what we need to do now is update that to current so that we know exactly what's going on there. And we also have to establish some new monitoring points that have been shown to us that need to be covered through the hearing processes, and some of our submitters have said, but you've forgotten about this, or you've missed that, or we think you should be doing this, and we're happy with that. And we've included them in our proposed management plans and conditions before you. So,
Alan, sorry. Is the 200 days a year that you're operating, is that contiguous, or is it likely to be broken up? So weather events, it's gonna be spread out across the year?
Sorry, I missed that. Is that it?
The 200 days a year that you're operating,
Yeah, it's not, we don't just operate for 200 days and have 100 off. But I think we've agreed, and we won't operate when there's a swell over 4 metres, so whenever that happens, we stop. And we actually have permission, or did have permission, and our EPA consents in 2017 to shift our vessels, in fact, relocate them to Queen Charlotte Sound or Tasman Bay, out of the way of a storm if it's a real bad one coming. That health and safety and other issues there, but yeah. No, it'll be on as we go along. But yeah, we only intend to utilise 72% of the time for 20 years. And the rest of that 35 years is 20 years of monitoring, and then we've got to do 5 years of post-production monitoring to ensure that everything is as it should be in terms of rehabilitation, and we provide that information.
Thank you. Okay.
Excuse me, I'll follow up question. You just said about information being updated. I didn't quite catch what exactly that referred to.
We've got, again, I'll leave that bit to Alison, but we know a lot about the South Taranaki Bay, and we've monitored, got a lot of monitoring information. But we need now to bring that to current, so that's absolutely 2 or 3 years just before we start. We know what's really going on out there, and that database is there, and then additive to that, oops, here's mining. What's happening here? How's that? But if we don't update that, you say, well, that's 2016 data, come on, you know. And that's part of the reason. And the pre-commencement monitoring also, like I said, identified, during the hearing processes, identified some other areas that was decided by including our opponents' experts, said that we think you should be doing this. Okay, we took it on board, we've included it in our new plans. Okay. And that brought us to the independent, we did bulk sampling and pilot plant processing. It's not a guesswork about how much iron ore and vanadium and titanium we're going to produce. We built a pilot plant in Wellington, out of Porirua, and we spent about 5 or 6 years putting bulk samples through that pilot plant, and that was all IATA approved and tested plant, registered plant, independently verified. And we got a JORC, which is the Joint Ore Resource Committee's mineral code, which we need to have to a standard, one, to bank it, but two, to report any numbers to the Australian or New Zealand stock exchanges. So it's a JORC resource. This here is just one of our latest vessels when we've finally finished. This is the a shallower rig. What happens is this frame gets launched onto the seabed and it stands there. It's not anchored, it just sits there. And then umbilical cords come out, and all the hydraulics and the sampling equipment and the cyclones and things are all on the vessel, and it drills. And we don't have to get, there's nobody on the seafloor, and we don't have to go down there and change rods or anything. We have 11 metres of rods in here. Now the reason, I got a bit sidetracked before, the reason we can't go deeper than about 10 metres is simply, this is only economic where we're in our high-grade material. And once we get down to about 10 or 11 metres, we're starting, because of the angle of repose of these supersaturated sands, we're starting to suck material from too far away, And we would also dig too deep a hole, take too long to get out of it, and with natural storm events and various other things, that site would be contaminated very quickly, the seabed movement, and we'd lose our break control. So we can only harvest that top 5 metres on average. Some places are only taking a metre off the surface. Other places, like I said, we do get to 11 metres, that's the maximum. And there's technical reasons for that. It's something, a vessel a bit like this, where we plan, if you're going out there, we would take you out on this vessel. The resource, I won't bore you with the resource, it's a technical thing, but I will just say that, as you can see here, nearly 2 billion tonnes of it sits outside in the EEZ, and about 1.3 billion tonnes of it sits on the inside in the CMA. And that is the subject, and that will be the justification, is the justification for turning this into a mining licence. I think you'll be aware that this is the last area within, from Wellington Harbour to Manukau Harbour, this is the last area within the coastal management area that is available for mining. Because the mineral exploration and mining is not a permitted activity in the Maui Dolphin Reserve, which got extended out to 12 nautical mile limit right along that coastline, and has sterilised large, very large commercial resources. But that's a matter for another day. The resource is about 10% Fe2O3, less than 0.05% V2O5 or vanadium pentoxide, and about 1% TiO2 or titanium dioxide. It contains 1.6 million tonnes of vanadium pentoxide. That's a lot. When we concentrate it, over 20 years, we will mine 1 billion tonnes or 1,000 million tonnes, and we'll produce a concentrate of about 57% iron, which is in fact about 81% Fe2O3, very high grade, 0.5% vanadium pentoxide and about 8.5% TiO2. Tell you more about the economics of that, but that's about 11 pounds of vanadium pentoxide in the concentrate. 5 million tonnes a year will be exported. Righto. The EEZ Act, interesting. The purpose of the EEZ Act is to promote the sustainable management of natural resources of the exclusive economic zone and the continental shelf. This Act provides for the sustainable management means managing the use, the development, and protection of natural resources in a way or at a rate that enables people to provide for their economic well-being. It is not primarily an environmental act to protect the environment at all costs. The EEZ Act incorporates comprehensive environmental safeguards and international guidelines that seek to balance economic development with environmental protection. It is not a no-effects legislation and permits mineral recovery where impact on the environment can be remedied, mitigated, or if other interests, including economic benefit and efficient use and development of natural resources, are justified. That's what the EEZ Act says. That's what we're here primarily to get approval under. We're not here to bypass the EEZ Act or take shortcuts over environmental protection or avoid environmental protection. We're here to comply with that Act. The Fast Track Act, I'll get on to next, provides the way forward for us. I've got down the bottom there, it also includes precautionary principle, and you people as planners and commissioners and things would have heard a lot about that, and also the courts have had a lot to say about that over the years as well. I'll put it simply at the moment that the precautionary principle is basically, this isn't legal, but this is what it means. If you've got insufficient information, you don't know, you don't do. And the precautionary principle reverses the burden of proof. The individual or entity proposing an activity must prove the activity is not harmful. There's a number of analogies, so I'll get onto dangerous ground, I think, if I start sprouting them. But it's very, very hard to prove when you get permission to do anything that something else might not happen. And I think I'll leave that at that point. But we're very aware of that. And that is what a lot of the arguments, which I'll get to a bit later, have been about in the courts. The Fast Track Act, passed on the 23rd of December 24, is a one-stop shop to facilitate the delivery of infrastructure and development projects with significant regional and national benefits. I think I've already started to demonstrate, and I will when we get to further into this, that this is certainly a regional project of regional and national significance. The elevation of the Fast Track's purpose over the RMA and EZ Act when considering the application for approval is limiting the ability to decline applications to only when adverse impacts are sufficiently significant to be out of proportion to the project's regional or national benefits. The Act's one-stop shop is to bring it all together under one umbrella and hopefully streamline the process, but not, in my view, or our view, to avoid anything. And I'll tell you a bit more about our application in it too. Excuse me if one or two of the dates are wrong here. I just heard another date or two from the chair that I haven't got on here. But this on the left, as you know, is the fast track process in the legislation and the regulations. And on the right is, this is how our application is fitting in to the fast track process. So the Act was passed in December 24. Applications opened on the 7th of February. We were too busy. We'd read the Act over Christmas and we were too busy with our team putting together an entirely new application to suit the fast track. This is not 2016 application sellotaped up. It's a new application. We applied on the 15th of April. We were notified a month later that the application was complete. It was not rejected. The panel convener was then gets advice and a number of reports, I think which the chair here has referred to. And we had a panel conveners conference on the 7th of July, which a number of parties were invited to. And the expert panel of five was appointed and announced on the 12th of August. And you commenced your duties looking at the task before you on the 25th of August. And we're now the first opportunity we've had to present it to you today. Invited comments, I apologise if that date's wrong. That's how we worked it out at the time the other day, but whatever, the dates are what they are. But certainly we know that we've got 100 days, I think, from your comments and responses. It takes us to the 4th of March with about 10 business days and the decision will be published. And the Minister and us have got an opportunity to comment on that draft decision, I believe. And then we need to wait, which is in the schedule here, we need to then see whether or not there are any judicial appeals to that decision for another 20 business days. And unfortunately, Easter gets in the way. So it takes us out for a little while. I don't want to be too cheeky, but this is the Fast Track Act. I'd like to see it a bit faster, but that's what it is. That's over a year. So our application. The Fast Track application includes a new pre-feasibility study. It's a major document. I think you've got about 15,000 pages of information in front of you, and 5,000 pages of those are the feasibility study. That is a brand new document, 2025. It is nothing sellotaped up from previous. And that's what the whole project is based on, along with this new chalk mineral resource statement, vanadium and titanium. If you look at the 2016 applications and decisions, vanadium and titanium were never mentioned. It was only iron ore and iron sands. These have come to the fore since then, and we've redone this work to ensure that we've got the basis for the project. We then got the New Zealand Institute of Economic Research to do an economic impact assessment, which is 2025, to demonstrate the benefits. We haven't asked these people we haven't suggested what the outcomes would be. We give it to them, we give them the information, they run it, they give us their report. They're totally independent. And we've done extensive ongoing consultation and updated that. A full review, and Alison will tell you a lot more about this in particular, A full review and update of the previous 2016 application packets, including effects on marine mammals and seabirds. These are some of the areas that were considered perhaps deficient by the previous hearing in Hawe, and perhaps the Supreme Court judgment. Updated the sediment plume modelling, and addressed the High Court, the Court of Appeal, and the Supreme Court judgments were all addressed, and Morgan will take you through those. Okay, as I say, it includes an update of the court judgments, and I would just like to say, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a geologist, as I've said, but the court judgment, no court in this land has banned seabed mining. They've suggested things could be done better. I accept that. And what the judgment did say at 2029, given the complex and evolving nature of the issues involved, it would not be appropriate to deny TDR the opportunity to have the applications reconsidered. That's what the court said. And TDR should be able to remedy matters if it can. Importantly, the Supreme Court judgment provided a summary of the legal deficiencies of the original consent grants and the legal framework to address these when the grants are reconsidered by the EPA's DMC. I've got to be careful what I say here, but it wasn't actually TTR that was in the firing line here. It was how the EPA managed the application of granting those consents and its application of the law. Our consent conditions and our operations could not be challenged in the courts. It was only on points of law about how that process had been undertaken. We were forced to defend it, of course. And we didn't go to court. We were taken to court by our opponents to the High Court. We were then in a position where we had to either abandon our project or pursue it through. And we believe this is a good project. We believe we've done the work. We pursued it. Okay.
Can I ask you just to pause there, Mr. Regis, for a moment? I should have said this earlier, but we're going to take a break for morning tea. And you've been talking for a while, and you could do the rest.
Probably.
So we'll take a break now, I think. That seems a convenient point to, move on to another topic for 15 minutes.
Yep.
We'll resume then and have lunch between 12:30 and 1, and then we'll stop again for afternoon tea around about 3:15.
That'll be good. I think I'll be through, and I think we'll be ready for my team to go probably about lunchtime or sooner.
All right. Okay. So we'll take a break now for 15 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I've got one.